From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Chaos and confusion in Iowa. This morning, there's a delay in the Iowa caucus results after an unprecedented problem reporting vote totals.
For decades, the Hawkeye State has carried the notoriety of being the first presidential test in the nation. But after Tuesday's meltdown with results, Iowa's status is in jeopardy for 2024. Governor J.B. Pritzker says it's time for Illinois to be first.
Because our state is so representative, so much more representative of the United States, I really believe that we have so much to offer to this process. If you can win in a state like Illinois, with so many different regions, so many different types of people from all over this state, if you can win in a state like this, then you're worthy of being the nominee of your party.
Another former Illinois politician appeared in federal court on a bribery charge.
Luis Arroyo is one of several local lawmakers to face corruption charges over the course of a few months. He pleaded not guilty to a charge that he allegedly bribed a state senator.
Knowing what I know now about the statute, if I were asked to come in tomorrow and do this role again under the same rules, I would not do that because I do think that it would be a waste of time.
That was Julie Porter, a past legislative inspector general. The General Assembly's watchdog was unsparing in her critique of the current ethics regime for state lawmakers. She says the 8-member Ethics Commission squashed a report of serious wrongdoing by a sitting legislator, plus another plea from another state rep accused of corruption. And does the meltdown in the Iowa caucuses open a window for Illinois? This is State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Sean Crawford is away. Joining me from the studios of NPR Illinois on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. He's also a longtime State House observer and reporter. And on the line is Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Dan, welcome back to State Week.
Hi, Brian. Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, let's start with this ethics hearing. This came on Thursday. It was in Springfield, and it was a long hearing. And I think the most interesting news to come out of it were the comments of Julie Porter, the former legislative inspector general. Can you give us a rundown of what she had to say?
Sure. And these were not new comments from Ms. Porter, who wrote an op-ed about her opinion of the power of the legislative inspector general in our pages back last April. But basically, she said that the Legislative Ethics Commission, this bipartisan panel of 8 lawmakers, which gets to vote on whether the inspector general's findings of wrongdoing get released to the public, blocked a report that she wanted to release on serious wrongdoing by a lawmaker. And she, in the op-ed last year, had similar complaints about a previous report. She and Carol Pope, the current legislative inspector general, and Tom Homer, the state's original legislative inspector general, all had a lot to say at the hearing yesterday about the lack of independence of this person who's supposed to be the watchdog of behavior by state legislators.
And I realize
they can't. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I realized maybe I should add the context of what this hearing was. This was the General Assembly's great effort at trying to craft some new ethics rules and laws, potentially in the wake of the numerous corruption scandals that have been plaguing the General Assembly.
Correct. And, you know, this inspector general, they have to get permission from this group of lawmakers, the Legislative Ethics Commission, to open an investigation, to issue subpoenas, to then, when they find that wrongdoing has been committed, to make that report public. And all 3 of the current and former inspectors general don't believe that that's a workable system, believe that it allows lawmakers to have too much of an opportunity to protect their own, essentially.
And Dan, in the instance to which Ms. Porter referred, wasn't the attorney general also involved?
Yes, part of the process is when it's a serious enough issue, it's referred to the Attorney General, and they're actually the one that brings a complaint before the Legislative Ethics Commission. And, you know, this was serious enough in this instance. The Attorney General felt that there was enough information to bring a complaint, and yet we are not allowed to know what happened because the Legislative Ethics Commission voted not to release any information about it, and everyone who knows that information is bound by confidentiality.
One of the arguments that's been made for that is that, particularly in cases involving sexual misconduct, the victim does not want to be identified. I've always thought that you can say these charges were brought and this is the allegation. You don't necessarily have to name the person. I mean, look at the Associated Press. They write about sexual assaults all the time, and they never use victim's name unless the victim allows them to or wants them to.
And you don't even have to look that far. If you look at the Office of the Executive Inspector General within state government, they release reports all the time. I've written about a few of them over the past year of sexual harassment or things like that within state government, and they do it in a way that protects the identity of the victims.
And Dan, she talks about, and maybe you can just expound on this a little bit, some of the things she would like to see. You mentioned the idea of being able to open an investigation without permission. But she goes into some detail about just being able to publish reports. And I'm reading from her prepared remarks, which she didn't, interestingly, she did not get to give orally at the hearing because they were trying to speed things along in this multi-hour hearing. But she said, you know, she's bound by confidentiality and cannot reveal the reasons for my deep concerns about the way the commission is wielding this power. And that's the power to decide whether or not to publish. Can you talk a little bit about some of the other things that she and Porter and Homer say ought to be changed here?
Well, one of the real issues that they brought up, and they said that, you know, it doesn't happen in every instance or even all that often, but there are cases where this 8-member panel that's made up of 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats, 2 each from the House and the Senate, split along party lines, and it's a 4-4 tie on whether or not to release, and you need a majority to decide to release the report. So, you know, they discussed the idea of possibly adding a citizen member, a nonpartisan person, to the panel that could break those ties, doing away with the, like you said, the having to come to the Legislative Ethics Commission to get permission. Lots of different ideas for how this office could be made more independent.
Yeah, and I thought that was an interesting idea. Lawmakers have so sort of jealously guarded the power to, you know, police themselves here, whether they would put this in the hands of, you know, even one non-legislator member, let alone an entire commission of non-legislators. Charlie, I wonder if you have any thoughts on the likelihood of that happening.
I would guess it's probably not very likely unless the public outrage becomes so strong that it's more politically expedient to go ahead and do it than not to. That's usually how any reforms in the area of ethics occur around here, is when lawmakers realize that it's painful as it may be to impose some restrictions on ourselves, the danger of not doing it is greater. But some of the things that have been suggested just make common sense. For example, legislators should not be lobbying other areas of other governmental units on behalf of clients. The disclosure forms are kind of meaningless. They should be a lot more explicit in terms of what someone's interests are so that voters and citizens can see what potential conflicts there are. And the Ethics Commission should not have that kind of power over the independent, supposedly, Inspector General. You want an Inspector General whose hands are going to be untied so that that individual can follow the clues wherever they go and come out with reports. Because if you have a situation where there's a bipartisan panel and it's, let's say I'm in Party A and I get in trouble, my colleagues from Party A on the commission can just bury it. That's not a very workable situation in my judgment.
Dan, you were trying to get in there a moment ago with something about with a comment from Tom Homer, I think.
Yes, yeah. He talked about this idea of, you know, when scandals arise in state government, there's this window of opportunity for lawmakers to enact reforms that address the issues that have arisen. That's how this Office of the Legislative Inspector General was created in the first place back in the early 2000s. You know, we saw it again after the post-Rad Blagojevich era, where there were lots of recommendations for changes to be made, and only a few of them were taken up. And so now this is sort of a new, you know, once every decade or so window of opportunity. And the question is, how much appetite is there going to be for doing things that are going to substantially change the way business operates in Springfield, in City Hall in Chicago, and some of these suburbs that have been brought into to these federal investigations. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out over the next few months.
You know, Dan, before we move off this topic, something that intrigues me here, we are in an era of leaks, right? Whether it's WikiLeaks or of the more analog variety, you and your colleagues have reported, as have other reporters at BEZ and the Sun-Times in Chicago, on, you know, various aspects of the federal investigation that were not public. But, you know, you guys cite sources and say, for example, that Senator Terry Link was the person named as the state senator who wore a wire on a state representative who we'll be talking about in a few minutes. Are you surprised that there are these now one or two or I guess three mystery cases of wrongdoing found by the legislative inspector general that we don't know about? I mean,
well, it's, I would say that it's not for lack of trying. Legislative inspectors general, current and former, take their duties of confidentiality very seriously, as it seems do members of the Legislative Ethics Commission. You know, I'm thinking at some point maybe people will be able to piece together based on various pieces of evidence what might have been the case in each of these instances. But at this point, you know, it's sort of following those breadcrumbs.
Yeah. Well, that is something I'm sure we will continue to watch. And I will end with this, Dan. Any indication of how the lawmakers received the comments from Julie Porter, Tom Homer, and current Inspector General Carol Pope?
Based on the questions they were asking and the tone of their questions and responses, it didn't seem like the reception was overly warm. You know, they have a lot of concerns about the complaint process being politicized, things along those lines. You know, there is this concept of, you know, what is conduct unbecoming of a legislator, and how maybe that's ill-defined and needs to be better defined. So I wouldn't be surprised if they make some tweaks around the edges, but I don't know if we'll see sort of the wholesale changes that the inspectors general were proposing.
Well, arguably, the very reason that this hearing existed and the commission is doing its work, the Commission on Lobbying and Ethics Reform is doing its work, is because of something that happened on the very first day of the veto session last year. That was the arrest of then-State Representative Luis Arroyo, a Democrat, and he was accused of bribery. Dan, this week he was in the federal court in Chicago entering a plea to those charges. Can you tell us what plea did he enter?
He pleaded not guilty, which my colleague Jason Meisner, who covers federal courts for us, explained in his coverage of the hearing this week, that the way the plea was entered and sort of the mechanics of the federal court system indicates that he may still be cooperating with authorities, may change his plea to guilty at a later date. He was in addition to pleading not guilty, waived his right to be charged by an indictment, and they charged him instead with a criminal information, which is sort of a less detailed document, and that for people who observe the federal courts on a regular basis, like Jason do, is an indication that the plea may change down the road.
And I'm glad you mentioned this, because it struck me that, you know, Arroyo enters a not guilty plea this week, and Jason and the other sort of courthouse experts up there say, oh, this is an indication that he's cooperating. Meanwhile, former state senator Martin Sandoval entered a guilty plea last week, and the same people said, oh, this is an indication he's cooperating. I guess he actually said he was cooperating in court. So I'm glad you sort of reconciled that. Can you remind us, what is Arroyo charged with doing?
He is charged with bribing a sitting state senator who, as you mentioned, we have reported is Senator Terry Link from Lake County, based on what sources told us.
Although Link denies that.
But yes, Link, Link has vehemently denied that he is the person who's cooperating. But the feds say Arroyo agreed to pay kickbacks in exchange for support of legislation that would support sweepstakes gambling, which Arroyo was lobbying on behalf of a client at City Hall here in Chicago who is in the sweepstakes gaming industry. And so that's sort of, you know, the Sandoval thing was already going on when Arroyo was arrested, but this sort of set off the idea of this crisis and the need to put together this task force to look at ethics. And this whole idea of legislator lobbyists has arisen out of that as well.
And there has been some additional fallout from this, I'll mix my metaphors here and say more dominoes continuing to fall. Pick your metaphor. But the Arroyo vacancy left an opening in the Illinois House of Representatives, which was filled by a woman named Eva Dina Delgado. And Dan, this week, her qualifications were challenged. Can you tell us what prompted that?
That's right. So the way it works in the General Assembly is that when you resign your seat midterm, the local party leaders in your party get to get together, and based on the vote in the last general election for you, get in their particular wards or townships or whatever the local unit is, get a weighted vote to pick somebody to replace you. Now, it just so happens that in addition to being a state representative, Luis Arroyo is a ward committeeman here in the city. He resigned his legislative seat but did not resign from his party position, so he had the largest share of the weighted vote in choosing his own replacement. He didn't attend the meeting where Representative Delgado was selected. He gave his vote by proxy to an alderman named Ariel Reboiras, who then had the majority of the vote and could appoint Delgado to the seat. She says she is not Luis Arroyo's candidate. He was out circulating petitions for another candidate. But, you know, Speaker Madigan had warned the local leaders here not to use Arroyo's votes to pick his successor. They went ahead and did it anyway. He said that there would be a qualifications challenge to possibly remove her from the seat if that happened. And then she was seated, and it was quiet until this week when House Republican leader Jim Durkin and Ann Stavamurray, a Democratic rep from Naperville, each filed petitions with the House clerk challenging the legitimacy of Delgado's appointment to that seat.
And Madigan seemed to back down in comments, or at least his spokesman said that, I believe I'm paraphrasing here, but that Madigan was more speculating than sort of vowing that he would file the qualifications challenge. And Dan, I think it's pretty clear that you cannot call neither Jim Durkin nor Ann Stavamurray proxies for Speaker Madigan, right?
No. Representative Stavamurray has been sort of one of the few Democrats who's been outspoken about her, I don't know if distaste is the right word, but trying to, you know, distance herself from the speaker. She's in a traditionally Republican district, so it doesn't, you know, favor her to be seen as closely aligned with the speaker. And Jim Durkin, as anyone who watches the State House knows, is no fan of the speakers. You have to work together when they want to try to get things done, but he's often very critical of his counterpart in the majority party.
Charlie, I can't remember the last time there was a qualifications challenge for someone in the General Assembly. Can you bring some historical perspective to this?
I cannot cite the exact date, but there was a situation where a woman was elected to the House from a district in the Illinois River Valley area. I think LaSalle, Peru, Peg Breslin was her name. And the Republicans, she was a Democrat, the Republicans challenged her on the grounds that she had not resided in the district for the requisite amount of time because she had been, I believe, going to school in Chicago. And on a party line vote, they kicked her out. And then she got, and this was shortly before the election, she got elected, came back, served in the legislature, and became an appellate court judge. And I want to say this would have probably been in the late 70s, early 80s.
So, Dan, what do we know about the process going forward? Do we expect a swift resolution here, or is this going to linger until after the primary, kind of take a wait-and-see approach?
Well, it all kind of depends on how the speaker decides to proceed. The House rules call for the creation of a committee to review the challenge, hear evidence. Representative Delgado would have a chance to state her own case and explain why she should be able to remain in the seat. But as of yet, no committee has been formed. And Alderman Reboiras, who I mentioned before, also has threatened to take legal action if the House does remove Representative Delgado. The argument that he and other people who supported her appointment made is that this is a majority Latino district, and it would be disenfranchising voters there who elected Luis Arroyo if, you know, the selection is nullified by the House.
Did the House rules set a deadline for this committee to be formed and for some report to be made?
That is a good question that I don't know the answer to off the top of my head. I know there was a 90-day deadline from her seating for them to file the
complaints.
Petition.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that there is a deadline for formation of the committee. As you mentioned, there's a primary coming up. Delgado is on the ballot. She's running against a teacher here in Chicago. So she's kind of got to run her campaign and now possibly deal with this qualifications challenge at the same time.
Yeah, because if you wait until after the primary to determine it, it could all be moot because, if I'm not mistaken, there's not even a Republican running in that district, is there?
There is not, no. I suppose they could always, slate somebody for the November ballot after the primaries, but it's a pretty heavily Democratic district. It'd be a huge shock.
Well, that's happened maybe 150 times in the past, and only one of those candidates has been successful.
All right. Well, we will wait and see what the House does with that. The last thing we're going to talk about today is actually Iowa. I know this is an Illinois state politics and government show, but the meltdown in the Iowa caucuses this week seems to have given some Illinoisans the idea that there is an opening for first-in-the-nation status in terms of the presidential nominating process. Dan, bring us up to speed with what people are thinking here in Illinois.
That's right. Governor J.B. Pritzker went on Twitter and has said publicly later this week that he believes that Illinois, because it's more demographically representative of the United States as a whole, with racial and ethnic diversity, a major metropolitan area, large rural areas, should have a larger role in choosing who our presidential candidates are. As my colleague Rick Pearson, our political writer, pointed out on Twitter after this, Illinois is also a very incredibly expensive media market. With Chicago, it's much more expensive than getting on TV in Des Moines or in the Quad Cities or places like that. And Pritzker had to spend, $171, I think, million dollars of his own money to get elected here in Illinois. So not exactly a friendly place for somebody looking to start sort of a grassroots presidential campaign.
Charlie, what do you think? Should Illinois move up to the first in the nation primary? I'm trying to think of, we have such long periods of time in terms of when you have to submit petitions and things like that. It just makes the election season that much earlier if state and local candidates are going to run on the same calendar.
Well, and see,
that's
the big qualification, because unless I'm mistaken, Iowa does not have primaries set in January for people running for state office or even for Congress, for that matter. New Hampshire doesn't have its primary for local candidates until way late in the season. So you could do a presidential primary ahead of time and then do the local ones later in the year. As a matter of fact, we did try going early once. I believe it was in 2008 when Barack Obama was first running, because we scheduled it for early February because we wanted to give Obama a boost. So there is the precedent. The difficulty in doing a separate presidential primary would be the cost involved.
Dan, I when we talked to the governor this week, I had this question formulated, and then someone asked a more concise version of it, so didn't get to ask it. But my initial reaction to Governor Pritzker's call on this was, if Illinois had had the presidential primary this week, it would have been accompanied by stories about the Secretary of State's office registering people who are apparently not citizens, or at least declared they were not citizens, in the driver's facilities, register to vote, forwarding 16-year-olds to the Board of Elections to register them to vote, and then on top of that, disenfranchising people who should have had their voting rights restored after they were released from the criminal justice system. And I kind of thought, well, maybe Republicans will use this opportunity to pile on, the Democratic governor and Secretary of State and the Board of Elections, but that's not actually what happened.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising. And actually, Republican Party leaders in the state got on board with this idea of moving up the primary to be one of the first or one of the first. you know, not to mention all the voting related issues that have been percolating over the last few weeks here in Illinois, but there's all the ideas about corruption too. And it's not just here in Illinois that Illinois has a reputation for political corruption. It's, you know, it's a national reputation. So I've seen a fair amount of commentary about that as well. Like, you know, do you want to start the presidential election process off in a state known for it? You know, it's, political issues.
It would certainly bring some additional scrutiny, and frankly, as a political and government reporter, I am not looking forward to spending my time in diners watching parades of politicians shake hands every 4 years. Four years, right? Or 3.5 years, I guess. But that's all the editorializing I'm going to do this week on State Week. Time now for Notes from the Field. Dan Petrella.
Well, late last night here in the federal court in Chicago, a monitor who's in charge of overseeing patronage hiring or anti-patronage hiring efforts in the state made a filing and said that the Pritzker administration has put new restrictions on their communications with state agencies, making it harder for them to do that job, which is a little bit ironic because just last week in his State of the State address, J.B. Pritzker said the old patronage system needs to die finally and completely. His administration denies that they've put these restrictions in place, but it's an argument that's going to play out in court.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, Governor Pritzker marked a milestone of a sorts this week when, for the first time in his tenure as governor, one of his vetoes was overridden. It had to do with reinstating a tax break for airplane repair companies in Illinois, and it had been allowed to expire without anybody noticing it. And an aircraft company down in the Metro East area was faced with having to shut down without having that tax break. And so the legislature passed it in the fall veto session with, I believe, only one dissenting vote in both houses. Pritzker vetoed the bill, saying giving private aircraft companies tens of millions of dollars in tax forgiveness isn't the right fiscal decision. But he was overridden easily. And as I say, it's the first time it's happened to him. On the other hand, he only vetoed, out of last year's session, 8 bills. He mandatorily vetoed one of them. And this aircraft tax break was the only one the legislature overrode.
And I just want to note this week the departure of a number of people from the Chicago Tribune, despite sort of having a very bad run of luck in terms of management over the years. It seems to still be getting worse with the hedge fund Eldon Capital coming in, a number of buyouts taking place. Dan, sorry to do this in front of you, but just on a personal note, Dawn Rhodes has done an excellent job covering higher ed in Illinois. I'm going to miss her coverage, which helps keep me informed on what's happening. And Greg Cott, who's been a longtime music critic. Glad to say, though, that he will be continuing to do sound opinions on public radio. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.